I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, bringing you a Floydcast number 42 for December the 1st, 2014. Something happened in the news this last week, and I wanted to talk about it. I think it was the greatest action by a person or persons in the public eye ever. I'm referring, of course, to the Richard Sherman news conference, where they did a parody in front of reporters. Happened last Tuesday, and it took a lot of guts. It took a lot of daring. Basically, Richard Sherman and another player on the Seattle Seahawks football team came out. The other player had a cardboard cutout in front of themselves, and they started a dialogue. Richard Sherman started off by saying, "You know, the other day, Marshawn Lynch got fined $100,000. Did you know that? They wouldn't have paid him $100,000 if he had talked to the media, i.e. before the fine. And this is true. They fined a player $100,000 for not talking to the media." So then Sherman says, "Geez, Louise, but you know who pays me a lot of money? Beats by Dre. The wonderful headphones I wear. But the league doesn't let me say anything about them." And he's referring there to the fact that you're not allowed to wear your headphones within something like an hour or an hour and a half of game time, before and after. They don't want you advertising your product during their game, basically. His teammate says, "I don't know, it sounds kind of hypocritical. NFL policy states that players are not allowed to show or use items with non-NFL sponsor logos 90 minutes before or after games." There you go. "Yeah, it sounds a little bit hypocritical," Sherman continues. "Seems like we're in a league where they say, players, please don't endorse alcohol. No DUIs, please. But yet a beer company is their biggest sponsor." Well, this is so true, and I've talked about it as well. Forget there was some incident to do with drinking that I talked about in the Floydcast where they're making such a big fuss about it, and yet they sell beer and all their fans are drinking beer. It is completely hypocritical. Very interesting, very interesting. It's crazy. In the off-season, you get to wear Neff beanies, you get to eat Campbell's soup. He tells a story about Campbell's soup. "Speaking of health, how do you feel about the NFL making you play 2 games in 5 days? And as it happened, the Seattle Seahawks had to play 2 games in 5 days last week." Sherman says, "I didn't realize that. They've been talking about player safety so much. 2 games in 5 days doesn't seem like you care about player safety very much." "Looks like you've been eating good," Sherman says to the other guy. "What kind of sandwiches have you been having?" "You know, I like to eat fresh, so I eat Subway. And I wash it down with a bottle of Martinelli's. This is like an apple juice. Sounds like a great beverage. It's fun to use your time in the NFL for something you care about, right? Then you don't get fined $100,000. You don't get fined at all for this," referring to the news conference. "This is how they want us to talk. This is what they want us to do. They want us to advertise. Gotta make some money. Gotta not get fined. Any questions?" And then the other player says, "No, I don't think so." And they proceed to leave the interview without answering any questions. What was really fun, and it's always most fun when you watch the media spin on something like this. Basically, once in a while, good people get to make a point. It's very rare. And then you watch the spin step in. And then, well, it's either humorous or ugly, depending on my mood of the moment. In this case, they were trying to say that Richard Sherman was criticizing the NFL about player safety. That seemed to be his big agenda. Well, no, actually, his big thing was about advertising. Saying that you could lose $100,000 for not talking to the media, or you could literally step in front of the media and come up with an absurd scenario where you promote 5 or 6 products and not lose a penny, and, which he didn't mention in the conference, he probably is going to get paid by these companies on the side. I'd be shocked if at least one of them didn't kick in some bucks. And who knows, maybe he was trying to raise $100,000 to give to Marshawn Lynch. You know, it's a really creepy media-driven world, advertising business, corporate-driven world. And this guy, Richard Sherman, the guy went to Harvard. He's not dumb. And he just so happens to be one of the greatest football players ever. And here he is taking on the big boys. It's truly wonderful. And I think he did it in such a way that either they don't know what he was trying to do, or they don't want to admit it. It's probably more like it. And It'll be interesting to see if Richard Sherman continues to get all the endorsements he's been getting. You know, this is a guy playing the game and not being a part. And it's my most daring thing of the week. Updates. We talked about the guy who pushed someone in front of a train last week. Turns out this guy had a lengthy criminal record, including 30 prior arrests on assault, robbery, and drug charges. Well, what I'd like to know is, when you arrest someone 30 times, why doesn't one of them stick? Why don't they spend some time in jail? You know, if it was Joe Innocent Person in the suburbs, they'd throw the book at him. And you'd spend 2 years less a day for probably half those charges. Well, if you just do the math, let's say you're in jail 10 times and it's 2 years less a day. That's 20 years. Clearly this wasn't happening. What was happening was this guy was going before a judge and then the judge was like, get out of here. And they weren't doing anything. That's how porous our justice system has become. Some people get nothing. Some people get everything. I was watching a show last night. It was a marathon on pit bulls and parolees. So it's a business that rescues dogs in New Orleans, as it happens. They have operated out of different places in the past. And they hire parolees, people just out of prison. Now that in itself is, you know, how many businesses do that? Almost no one, right? But then they're also rescuing pets. When the show starts, they tell you they have over 300 pit bulls. Well, the episode I watched, which is one of the newer ones, they were marathoning the newest season. They're up to 400 pit bulls. And apparently in this area, no one fixes their dog. They don't spend the small amount of money it takes to fix the dog. It produces just a really horrific situation. This world, you know, we live on one side of issues. We want a dog. Oh, it's so cute. The kids love it. But we don't want any of the consequences. We want to have a dog and treat it like a garden, I guess. We want the garden to produce food, and then we want to sell the food. We want to sell the pups. But we don't think about the mother. And we don't think about the fact that millions of dogs every year are killed because no one wants them. We want to bring more into the world. You know, really, anyone bringing any pet into the world is irresponsible. But no one cares, and everyone does it. When I say everyone, of course, many don't. But how many does it take doing it to really cause a massive problem? Then the rest of us have to basically chip in and either pay for shelters or we have to adopt pets ourselves just to break even. Just so that we aren't mass murderers. All because it's a dog we're talking about, not a human. I don't see the difference at all. We're creating a problem where we're raising a creature in an environment frequently that is inhumane. We're showing a complete lack of care and concern for something, and yet we're going to sell it to people where the people that are going to buy it are going to be caring for this pet. It'd be like trying to create, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize, cranking out having a little factory that makes them in a war zone. You can't get peace out of war, and you can't get happy kids with their puppy when you're cranking them out of a puppy mill. So this system is just really kind of hopeless when it comes to pets, and it's kind of hopeless when it comes to a guy getting arrested 30 times. So now he pushes someone in front of a train. Well, get this, he reportedly is suspected in a crime very similar to this one that took place just a month ago, in which a 51-year-old man was pushed to the floor of a subway platform in Manhattan. The victim came forward and identified Kevin Darden after seeing the video of him following the most recent incident. They also say Darden robbed an individual at a subway station in the Bronx just prior to the fatal push. You know, when you have a lack of punishment, you're going to get more crime. Is this what we want? Why don't we realize that you need capital punishment? It sends a message. It takes away the criminal's option. The guy who does 30 crimes, he will, in the back of his mind, he's got a little counter going. And he's like, you know, I'm at the stage where what I've done, they might kill me. They might arrest me, try me, convict me, and kill me. And at some point, the guy goes, I need to change. This is how people stop drinking or stop doing drugs. They get to a point where, hey, at some point, I gotta stop. on the show last night, one of the payrollees was a young guy. Oh yeah, that's what I was starting to mention on that show, was this young guy in school sold 9 grams of some drug. I don't remember what it was. That's a quarter of an ounce. I mean, it's such a small amount. It's like a thimbleful. And he sold it within the school to another kid, and the kid turned out to be an undercover cop. And they threw the book at him. And he went to prison for years. And he came out with a record and his life ruined. We can ruin one kid's life in a setup situation. But a guy, a grown man, who's assaulting people, robbing them. What was it? Assault, robbery, and drug charges. I mean, could it be worse than those three? 30 times. Kevin Darden needs to be killed. Send a message. If you really care, and there's no evidence they do, that's what needs to happen. What people don't realize is you're not killing someone in this case. You're leveling the playing field. And you're preventing dozens, hundreds, thousands of future deaths. This is an anti-death consequence. All right, last week I predicted that RG3, Robert Griffin III, the football quarterback for the Washington Redskins, predicted that things were going to go even worse for him. He's in a 4-year this year. In his 3-year, he had a disappointment. He had an injury. He couldn't play. And then this year, he had another injury, another operation. And then this year, he's playing terribly. Well, almost like the next day after I floodcasted, there was the headline, "What is his future like in Washington?" And now they're talking about which teams, you know, could he be traded for. So that happened pretty fast. And we're going to find out because he's in his maximum test cycles the next few months. It can only go badly based on the cycles. Another update. I had talked about Jason Brown, the football player who gave it all up and he became a farmer. The story, you know, to sort of get the maximum effect, the story had said he, you know, gave up football. In fact, he had been released by the Rams. I have a little bit of a calculation, just the letters under his name and what kind of birthday numbers he has. And basically, well, he's under a 9 strength, the number that he has got in, let's say, the healthiest way the healthiest amount of an excess of it is the 9 quality, and the 9 is that giving quality. That's more advanced stuff. But anyway, it's all in keeping with his numbers. Another update, Taylor Swift opens the American Music Awards. And in the story headline it says, "And she acts like psycho ex-girlfriend on stage." Well, of course, her acting, as they put it in the headline, is actually a video that she's performing. I'll have the link to that. And by the way, the crowd loved every minute of it. Then there was another story on RollingStone.com. Rolling Stone magazine is a famous music industry magazine. And they were giving out awards, American Music Awards 2014's 20 Best and Worst Moments. Well, one of the best moments, Taylor Swift's magical opening performance. Early in the song Blank Space, Taylor Swift promised, "I could show you incredible things," and she stuck to that promise during her AMA's opening performance. In addition to partially bringing the song's video to life, including the palatial dinner scene and a series of tux-wearing hunks holding picture frames, including one with "No" written on him, she lit a rose on fire with her hand and used her power to blow a man off the stage, creating more fire. In the end, she opened a red door with a claw mark on it to reveal the perfect mystery date, who has no idea what he's in for. And there was a picture on that Rolling Stone page showing her holding up the Dick Clark Award for Excellence. So basically, she goes to an award ceremony. She performs one of the opening numbers. She does a great job. She wins an award for excellence. And the HollywoodGossip.com says she acts like a psycho on stage in the headline of the story. This is the media. This is what the media is doing. Next story update. This is the lady and her husband went to Hawaii on a vacation. She was 6 months pregnant. She went into early labor. She had to be airlifted, had to stay there a while. $1 million bill for the delivery. Well, her Canadian medical provider has refused to pay. So they're left with options like taking the case up with the National Independent Insurance Ombudsman in Canada, entering mediation with the insurance companies, or going to court. I'm guessing that she's lost interest in going back to Hawaii. Another story on a different subject. Bees decline along with their favorite flowers. Bee populations are disappearing. Everything from pathogens, pesticides, and even diet has been blamed, but now researchers are pointing the finger at flowers. saying that these pollinators are in decline, along with their favorite flowers. Agriculture in the Netherlands is wiping out wildflowers that bees depend on for pollen and nectar, so consequently their population numbers are falling. This is a truly idiotic story, and this is Nature World News. This is basically a lie in my mind. It's so stupid. They're saying that lack of flowers is wiping out bees. Well, we've had a lack of flowers forever. We live in an artificial age. We artificially grow everything. There's been no sudden change in the flower ratio of wildflowers to non-wildflowers. There hasn't been a sudden change anywhere. There are gradual trends. You know, if you're talking the Amazon, gradually the Amazon is going away. It's all being chopped down. But it's gradual. It's not happening at an accelerated rate. One thing that is happening at an accelerated rate is wireless radiation. It's doubling and tripling probably every year or two. There's now something like a million times higher radiation than natural, than background. Really and truly, it is doubling and tripling every year. So 10 years ago, there was 30 times less radiation. And that's just a rough estimate. This is a massive change that's happening, and it's been demonstrated to be killing bees. So why are people writing these articles? They don't even list it as one of the possibilities. No one does. It's one of those taboo subjects. You don't talk about it. The lies will continue until the morale improves. All right, another update. Janae Rice, in her own words. So Ray Rice was the guy that, after a night of drinking, 2 a.m, they're going back to their hotel room, and they're clearly not happy. They're arguing. I think she takes a swipe at him, and he punches her and knocks her out in the elevator. The press makes a massive issue about it. Really, it was just a typical drunken moment. That's all it was. They were talking about domestic abuse and all that. Well, it wasn't a domicile. It was in a hotel. The press wants to amplify what they choose to amplify. And so they amplify the story off the charts. The league and the team that he plays for, the Ravens, they got involved. And basically, this is a super nice guy. He does all sorts of appearances. She still loves him. They got married shortly after. In other words, they both looked at it maturely and said, hey, this was a bad thing, but this doesn't represent how we feel about each other, and let's carry on. But the press wouldn't let it go. And so they suspended Ray Rice indefinitely. The thing is, he's making millions of dollars, so suddenly he's not making millions of dollars. And so their life became hell, basically. And interesting that Janae Rice, the name she married into, is the 775. So she married a whirlwind. She married in an accident with that combination. And that's exactly what happened, I mean, to her immediately afterwards. Well, she did an interview with Jamal Lewis. I'm sorry, I don't remember her last name. She's one of the excellent ESPN reporters, commentators. It's such a good interview. Janae Rice makes so much sense that I'm just going to have the link and you can check it out for yourself. I say in my notes, it's so entirely rational and it's so opposite of the media that I will let Janae do all the talking, except to say, stand down, media posse. Broncos release Brandon McManus. I watched this guy trying to kick field goals last week. He was just missing them. And the thing is, it was a close game and, you know, his team needed those field goals. And he'd missed something like 4 in the last couple of games. You know, there's some field goal kickers that can go like 5 or 10 years and maybe miss 1. I mean, they get streaks in the hundreds. They get 100 in a row. This guy was getting like 1 in a row. This guy's a rookie. But let's look at his name, Brandon 775, McManus 483. You know, it gives him a 268 total, 8 destiny. It's a good destiny. That's probably how he, you know, got into the NFL. But his names are poor. And that first name, that accident first name. Place kicking is mostly about your headspace. In other words, these guys have enough power, they can kick a field goal from 60 yards away. And the average kick is probably 30. So distance is not a problem. You just have to have your head totally, you know, in the right place, or you will make your own problems. I'm thinking this is what happened to him. All right, there's been, I guess, another story this last week that some people might have heard of. It involves a town back east called Ferguson. I don't know. I've just noticed it popping up in the news. What's really interesting, when you read the news stories, is that they want a slant. They want you to take a side. For example, if you're at all legalistic, like a lawyer say, or say you don't have a dog in the hunt. In other words, say you're not biased. You're just, you know, reading a random story for something to do. Well, you read the story of Ferguson, and the story is that two men were walking along. Two big men, by the way. One of them was like a large football player-sized guy, almost 300 pounds. And they were walking along. They had recently stolen cigars. And a cop comes along, and he sees them, and they're walking on the road. Even though a cop car is coming towards them, they're walking on the road. Now, you know, first impressions? How often do you stay walking on the road when a cop is driving towards you? I'm guessing never. So this piques the cop's curiosity, and he wants to talk to them. Wants them to get, probably among other things, like, what are you doing walking on the road? Why don't you get on the sidewalk? And they tell him that they're going to ignore him. Now, if you're a cop, I think you're already at the point of like, wait a minute, this isn't adding up. This isn't what normal people do. This is what people do when they don't like cops. Pretty obviously. Well, the guy's like, okay, I got to get out and talk to these guys. And at some point he puts it together that, you know, he had just been told by his base dispatch or whatever that someone had just robbed the store of cigars. So he knows that a crime's being committed, it's been phoned in. And now he's, in his mind, he's like, these are probably the guys. So he tries to get out of his car to talk to them, and the guys stop him from getting out of his car. That's assault. These days, to assault a cop, you could probably look at a cop and be charged with assault. It's really become incredible. There was a story, I didn't excerpt it, but there was a story where the FBI was getting services, like a building, I think, and they didn't pay their bills. This is the government not paying their bills. And the guy was trying to collect the money, and they basically said if he kept making an issue of it, they could throw him in jail for doing something against the FBI. That was the essence of the story. What they were basically saying to him is, it's illegal for you to try and make us pay. This is the level of corruption, and this is the amount of power that cops have. So when someone stops you from getting out of your car, and as you open the door, they slam your door shut, they have assaulted a cop. Now, this guy was by himself. By the way, as he was stopping to get out, he phoned into base and said, hey, I'm going to check out two guys here and send backup. Like, he knew he was getting into a situation. And then these guys made it worse before he even got out of his car. Well, then the next level of the story is they start assaulting him in the car. And by the way, there's proof of all this. There's witnesses. And there's, like, afterwards, there's blood in the car, in the cop car. So there was an assault in the cop car. On the scale, if you're trying to provoke a cop, let's just say this. You've already succeeded. You've already got this cop determined to do the maximum against you. The maximum, you know, appropriate. Well, this guy reaches for the cop's gun and points the gun at the cop. The cop wrestles the gun with the guy, and the gun goes off inside the cop car twice. This is clearly already a life or death situation. You know, only in America could some people, on hearing this story so far, go, yeah, you know, no big deal. Guy tries to steal your gun and tries to shoot you, and you fire a few shots inside your car. No big deal. Some of the facts are not, you know, absolutely clear. They're reported by people, right? And so you have to sort of decide what really happened. But at some point, these guys are... Oh, by the way, when the guy was first assaulting the cop, he says to the other guy, here, hold these for me, will you? He's handing him the stolen cigars. That's chutzpah right there. That's guts. Hey, hold on to my stolen cigars while I try and beat up a cop. That's someone that's, you know, feeling no pain. I wonder what drugs he was under. It does, to me, suggest he was under drugs. But, of course, they've had, you know, weeks to report on this. But no one is talking about what drugs was the guy under. They've already done the autopsy, I'm sure. Right? Why are they not revealing that? Well, it's all part of getting people to take sides. So you can see my side. I'm clearly biased. I'm white. I must be biased. In fact, that's all you need to know about me is I'm white. So I must be biased. So this, I'll just continue my biased story. So at some point, these guys are like trying to leave the situation. They're trying to get away. It turned out that the enormous, almost 300-pound guy was shot, like took one of the two bullets, you know, hit him somewhere. Not in a serious area, but enough to create that blood inside the car. And now they're probably thinking, let's get out of here. Well, the cop is thinking, I have some seriously dangerous people who are way beyond respecting any laws whatsoever. In other words, they'll do anything. They just assaulted a cop. They know this. You know, when a guy makes a run for it with his vehicle and the cops chase him down the highway, they hit him with everything in those cases. The person gets 10 years just for driving away quickly, nothing else. So these guys know what they're in for right away. Things have gotten out of hand, even by their standards. You know, for my standard, if I see a cop and I don't get over to the sidewalk right away, things have gotten out of hand for me. And if the guy talks to me, I'd be like, hey, you got me, sorry. I wasn't concentrating. I'm getting over right now. Thanks. Have a nice day. But I'm white. So I'll continue my bias story. So these guys start to move away from the vehicle. He backs up the vehicle and sort of reparks it. And he wants to get out again. Now you have to hand it to this cop. He's outnumbered 2-1. He's just been assaulted. And really, that's probably the only thing I would say if I'm doing the cop training class and showing this video. I would say, at this point, he should be following them, but he should be waiting for backup. They are too dangerous for him by himself. Anyway, he backs up, pulls his car in such a way that it sort of stops them, according to one of the reports I read, and he confronts them again. And the biggest guy starts to run towards him, and he shoots him. And you know, at first there were reports that he emptied his gun into him. Well, he didn't. When the whole thing was done, there was still one bullet in his gun that he didn't fire. But he did shoot this guy, and he did kill this guy. You know, he stopped a killer. That's what this story is about. A cop stops a cop killer. When you don't show respect for the cops, you're dangerous to the cops. Why didn't this guy show respect? Why was he stealing? Why was he stealing cigars? You know, I don't know why, but when it's a petty crime, I don't get it. If they were stealing Jaguars, or to make it more American, if they were stealing Cadillacs, I would get that, right? I'm not encouraging it, but I would get it. I would understand it. But why do you steal cigars? And when you steal cigars, why do you walk down the middle of the road, no matter who's coming? You're basically saying to the world, I don't care. I did what I wanted to do. These are my rules. I don't care. Why are they like that? What has happened in their world to make them like that? I don't know. The system has completely failed them, or they have completely departed from the system. Then they assault a cop. You know, it's comical. It's so ridiculous. You know, there are so many law-abiding people. There are so many reasonable people in this world. And then there are a few psychotic, insane individuals who do this sort of thing. And luckily, many of them get shot by cops. Well, in this case, he got shot by a cop. But that's where the real story starts, with the media. Because that's what this whole thing is about, is the media. This story has nothing to do with what a cop did, or for that matter, what a couple of thieves did. It has nothing to do with that at all. People get shot every day, and they get shot for a lot less than this. The press goes, how can we turn one of our enemies against the other? Because the press is the 1%. The 1% has a constant daily problem. How do we control 99% of the population? If we can do that, we can get all their money, and then we'll be rich because we'll have 100 times more money than the average. If you make $35,000 a year, the average 1%er is making $3.5 million a year. And believe me, that's pretty much bang on. They do it by theft, and it's theft from us. But what you have to do is you have to tie up the bear while you're stealing his food. So they incite. The stories incite. It's been really fascinating to read the stories. Because as it happened, I don't normally read the news or follow the news. But as it happened, the last couple of weeks, I wanted to do a real thorough reading of news stories to see in cases where there's, you know, murder and crime, just to show the numbers in action. And so as it happened, I was really on top of the story in terms of reading what came out. And then the big event last week. I guess they have a meeting to decide, should they indict the cop for what he did? And they decided that what he did was so reasonable, they weren't even going to have him appear in court at all. There was nothing to see here. Move on. And then that's when the media kicked in. Now, you've got to imagine the balls the media has got to step in when the legal process has already gone, nothing to see here, move on. And then media now has turned this into a circus. And the media has polarized people to a world-class extent. There were people talking about what the newspapers in France were reporting on this story. But if the press does their job right, if they do it properly, you won't notice the press. You might hate a given story, hate a given writer, and that's easy to do these days, because they are, many of them, lying scumbags. And so it's easy to dislike that. But they want you to not see the press. They want to create the problem, and they want no one to figure out what the real problem is. You know, it was some years back when I realized that the ugliest organization on the face of the earth, the most evil organization on the face of the earth, is religion. You know, you could almost say that if there was no religion, you wouldn't need the word evil. They created it. And that's what happens. When you judge others and you try and categorize them, you create a category. And by the way, you're in the negative half of the category. Religion creates good and evil. And by the way, they are evil. And you know, really, the good is when you are religion-free, really. Good is innate. You know, little two-year-olds and three-year-olds and four-year-olds, little kids are good. They're not perfect, but they're good. They know when they've been bad. I've heard stories where, you know, kids will put themselves in a timeout because they know they've been bad. They know good and bad. They don't need religion. None of us need religion. It's just pure evil. So why does it exist? It's part of that 1% controlling the 99%. It's a tool. It's a blunt instrument. If you can get people to waste their time on things, you will be able to control them. Well, people waste their time in religion, and that's an understatement. Now with Ferguson, people are going to waste their time in Ferguson. That's exactly what they want. They want people to take sides. They want people to waste their time. They want people to debate what doesn't need to be debated. It's like with the OJ trial. Again, I happened to be working from home at that time. I had cable TV at the time too, which I don't always have. And so I just had the trial on, and I just followed it. Trials are boring, and this one took a long time, but they go through all the evidence. And when I say go through, I mean they go through with a fine-tooth comb. What I remember, and this is what's not talked about with the OJ trial, they talk about things like the glove. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit, you know, all that kind of silliness. And they get OJ trying on the gloves while he's wearing a pair of gloves. Supposedly they're worried about evidence, so they have OJ put on a pair of gloves and then try on a pair of gloves. Shock of shocks, the gloves don't fit properly. Now, they already knew he bought gloves. They already knew he had gloves. But these gloves didn't fit. You know, it's so absurd. Well, with the evidence, the DNA evidence, and that's the real crux of the OJ trial, was the DNA evidence. They had all kinds of it, found everywhere. And they would give the number, the probability, that a given piece of evidence meant something. And they would say, well, the chances of a random person having this DNA match that OJ has is 1 in 4.5 billion. Then they present another piece of evidence, and An hour later, they'd say, well, the chance of him having the same DNA as this piece of evidence, 1 in 100 million. Well, what people don't realize is these probabilities are multiplied. They're not added. They're not just like, oh, that's interesting. In other words, the chance of one person matching each of these DNAs was 1 in 1 trillion trillion trillion. And that's not 3 trillion, that's 1 trillion times 1 trillion times 1 trillion. In other words, I guess if there was one Earth and every star in the Milky Way, and each of them had an OJ, well, this was the only OJ it could be out of all the others in the galaxy. Just the DNA evidence alone convicted him 10 times over. In fact, they said afterwards they had 10 times the evidence they normally have to convict somebody. But it's emotional. Some people should never be on a jury. They're emotional. And they acquitted OJ on emotion. Well, what's interesting is they then have the civil trial, and bang, he's convicted. $30 million settlement, right? Which, of course, he never pays because he has no money. And then he tries to pay the settlement and to have a little bit of spending money. OJ then takes part in a truly bizarre, I guess it was armed robbery, was how they categorized it, in a hotel. They set up a sort of a sting on a guy to try and get a lot of money in, or to take his stuff, take back OJ's stuff. And they pull off this ridiculous sting operation, and of course the courts go, no. And then OJ gets in prison. So the OJ case, there was never any doubt, ever, about whether OJ did it or not. There was never any doubt. So how did it get blown up so big? That would be the media. Without the media, there would have been justice, and people would have carried on about their day. They would have posted the result on a telephone pole outside the courthouse, and people would have gone, yeah, I figured. And people would have gone on about their day. And the press wouldn't have made any money from it. The press doesn't just make money from running a story. They make money from directing and controlling how people respond. That's their control. You know, the press is like a religion. The religion, you have the guy talking from the pulpit on Sunday, and that's how he controls his flock. Well, the press really is arguably, I mean, it's just no different. It's just more organized and more, you know, they're all working together. It isn't just one guy in one pulpit for one congregation. The press is everyone working together across the whole world. The JFK situation, when you look at it, when you study the informed material, for example, Jim Garrison's book, I really recommend it. You want to talk about worth reading. And isn't it fascinating? I live near 3 different library systems. These library systems probably have 100 million books in them. I mean, they're staggeringly large systems. And 2 of the library systems didn't even have his book. I think I only got it from 1 of the library systems. This is the guy who prosecuted Clay Shaw and who was trying to show there was a conspiracy. And he almost doesn't exist at the library. That tells you all you need to know about the JFK situation. That's a conspiracy in itself. It's almost impossible to imagine that an event as important as the JFK assassination is basically not covered in the library today. You want a really entertaining, really mind-blowing experience? Go to imdb.com, type in JFK into the little search box, click on it. Now you're on the JFK movie page. Go down to the bottom, and that's where the forums are. And there'll be like 5 forum threads, and then there'll be like a way to click more. When you click more, you'll see there are hundreds of threads. Choose any one of them with a bunch of replies in it, and you will see that half the people on that board are lunatics. They are beyond crazy. And the crazy people are the ones saying there wasn't a conspiracy. There was not a conspiracy. They will say it all day, every day, all year, every year. They've been saying it ever since I've been going to that IMDb, and I've been using IMDb for at least 10 years, maybe it's 20 years, a very long time, let's say 15. They know that on the key subjects they have to fight, they have to win, they have to lie, they have to be dishonest, they have to troll people, they have to flame bait them, they have to use every trick in the book to attack the good people who are just trying to get the truth. It's essential. So here we are in Ferguson, and it's essential for them. It's sort of hard for us to imagine, but this is the equivalent for the media. Ferguson is the equivalent of finding money on the ground and moving quickly to pick it all up. It smells of opportunity, and they love the smell of money in the morning. In my notes, I say, quick question. Have you learned to hate the media yet? Now would be a good time to start. Ferguson is all about the media. Once you change your focus and only focus on the media with a story like this, you will see the lies and you will see the craziness like it was shouting at you. And it's always the biggest of big boys doing it, the biggest of news sites doing it. It's not the Hoboken Courier writing a controversial story about Ferguson. They want to divide us. They want us in a category. What do you think of the verdict? Was OJ guilty or not? That's where they want us. OJ was more guilty probably than anyone that has ever gone through the court system. Each of those DNAs was 100 million to 1. The odds of it being a random person were 1 in 100 million. Each one of the DNAs was enough to convict him. And there was like 10 or 20. Then, of course, there's all the evidence found, all the suspicions. It's just like OJ, I think, left town or did something highly suspicious immediately after. Oh, yeah, and then there's that thing, OJ driving down the freeway with a gun to his head. Why did OJ do that? And he wanted to kill himself. Why did he do that? Why did he do that? Could it be because he was guilty? No. So the people of Ferguson have been useful to the 1%. The 1% incite hate. They do it all the time. Just stop and think about that. The people in control of us, they are hate inciters. They create hate. I realize that the media is a weapon of mass destruction. By definition, they are a weapon. They've incited people to burn down buildings. There's been people that have died because of the protests in Ferguson. So there's no doubt that they're a weapon. There's no doubt there's mass destruction. No doubt whatsoever. The media has caused every single solitary bit of it. By the way, the policeman who shot the very large man trying to kill him, that policeman had a perfectly balanced name. That's kind of interesting. In my notes, I have that the person killed weighed almost 300 pounds, 289 pounds, and that would be the last time they weighed him, right? I mean, cigar smoke doesn't add much to your weight, but, you know, he might have been another 10 or 20 since then, right? When was the last time this guy would be weighed? Maybe they weighed him after he's been shot. I don't know. He weighed 80 pounds more than the cop. Have you ever been around someone that weighs 80 pounds more than you? Especially someone that, I'm trying to think of how to say it, when someone's on a large frame, like they're tall, when I watch football players and marvel at their physiques and various things, you know, they tell you stats about these players. And many of them are, like in basketball, many of them are almost 7 feet tall. I can reach 7 feet. If I go off of my toes and I can reach 7 feet. That means I could just reach the top of some of the average basketball players. Well, you know, in football, they're similar heights to basketball players, a little bit shorter, but then they're like 50 or 100 pounds heavier. I remember once working with a guy. I had a kind of a crappy physical labor job. This guy was a nice, easygoing guy, just out of high school, kind of making a mess of his life, but that's another story. Anyway, he was a nice guy, and he was nice with me. You know, he was a friend. And how strong he was. He was going to go into football. He got an injury. I think his life derailed at that point. I think that's what really happened. He was a running back. So he was like 250 pounds. I always think of that guy when I think of a 250 pound person. This guy, as part of our job, you know, we had a generator at one point. He had to be able to lift a generator. Generator is an engine that you carry around with you. You know, when you're camping, they make a generator that's really small, right? It's got a handle and you carry it. But even then, I recently helped someone with a generator. They wanted to move it from one part of the garage to another. And I was able to move it myself, only just. Well, in this work environment, we had to get this generator onto the truck. There was no way to get it onto the truck other than lift it. Well, it's one thing to deadlift something, to lift it a few inches and then move it from one part of the garage to another like I did. It's another thing to lift it over your head and put it on the truck first thing in the morning. No warm up. That's how this job went. Well, he was like, Floyd, let me get it. And I was going to help him. And he's like, Floyd, let me get it. And he just picks it up himself and just puts it on the truck like it was nothing. That's what a 250-pound person does. So this person in Ferguson was 290 pounds. This is an enormous human being. And not enormous like world's heaviest man, bedridden. Not like that. In my notes, I say this story is all about pure media sleaze. You know, it's one thing to say that a group has no shame, which is true of the media. But when you realize that the press are causing Ferguson, they want what is happening to happen. They want riots. They want the hug. There was a hug as part of this whole thing. The two sides are protesting and they're calling out the military. There was like a town across the way from Ferguson. They were calling out the military to protect this town. So then you need a hug, right? You need a hug photo. It reminds me of the Robert De Niro movie, Wag the Dog, where the president in the movie does something that could get him into trouble with the public, and so they create a rumor about the B-3 bomber, and De Niro is the spin doctor, and he creates all these things that distract the public perfectly. Well, you know, this is all just spin doctoring. Every single bit of it. Here's one website. The headline of this the website story said that the cop's story is unbelievable, literally, is what the guy said. Well, you know, the guy wrote down this story. He was interviewed. He related his story numerous times. And the grand jury looked at all of his evidence. And they found his story completely believable. So believable that they had no reason to criminally try to, you know, prosecute the case any further, or legally try to prosecute the case any further. It was an open and shut case. But here's a guy saying the story is unbelievable. And one of the ways he was proving it is he brought in like a third witness. There was the cop's story that he wrote, and then there was the cop's story later on, and then there was some analyst, and then there was this third witness. And within about 5 seconds of reading the story, you realize the third witness is not credible. When you believe, you'll see what you want. In the OJ case, the jury believed what they wanted. The OJ case became a famous case for the jury going, yeah, but. That's basically what happened. Yeah, but I have doubt. That's really what saved OJ. They had doubt. Now, they didn't have doubt in an intelligent sense of the word. They just didn't have the feeling that they would attribute to being sure that OJ had done something. They just had a feeling of doubt. The case hung on a feeling. Rudy Giuliani weighed in on this, and he, famous quote of his, which they'll probably hang Giuliani out to dry for it. He said, 93% of blacks are killed by other blacks. It's a sad situation. I was trying to do the math, but roughly 100 people a day are murdered in the U.S. 100 times a day this happens. Murder is not a rare event in the U.S. And really, it's not a rare event anywhere. There are countries that are worse than the U.S. There are countries that are better. People get murdered all the time. Why did the press choose to make a big deal out of this? That's maybe the greatest mystery of this whole story. I would say it was just time. They got their own formula, they got their own agenda. And they were like, hey, you know, at this time of the year, you know, there's a bit of a gap between Thanksgiving and Christmas. We need a story to carry us. At Christmas time, people make a fool of themselves. We'll have a lot of drunk driving stories to talk about. And the new year, we can pretend we're optimistic and publish a couple of optimistic stories for a couple of weeks. And then life will carry on as normal in January. But we got to get to January. I don't know. How many people get fooled? How many people are sucked in? How many people have a side in Ferguson? How many people are labeled? He was guilty. He was fine. They should prosecute him. They should let him go. They did the right thing. How many people had been polarized? None of us were there. On average, no one was there. The number of people that were there was the cop, the two guys, one of which is dead, and then supposedly some witnesses who, how much were they there? They weren't in the cop car. How close were they? This event happened over a space of ground. In other words, these guys were walking, and then the cop is there, then he tries to get out, then they stop him, and there's a fight, and then the guys take off, and then the cop follows them. This happened over a stretch of ground. There was probably no witness that followed the whole thing, that saw the whole thing, one person. So none of us will ever know, for sure, what happened. So really, this is how we have to process it. We have to go, what's the story that's told? Does it sound reasonable? Is it backed up by some fact? All right. And then we have enough to make a decision for ourselves. And the vast majority of us have already done that, including the legal process has already done it. And they say there's no story here. But the press is involved. Fantastic. Fear the press, man. Fear the press. You know, I send out quotations, and so many of them talk about, you know, government. And 200 years ago, they were worried about the government, right? And they would say, you know, do you want a government that controls everything, or do you want a press that controls everything? And they would say a free press. And they would say, I'll take a free press over government management any day. But we have lost both. We've lost the press, and we've lost the government. I don't know if the question ever was meant to handle that scenario. Pretty much everything is lost when you've lost the press, and you've lost the government. It's easy to control people in government. It's just a matter of money. Set up a deal, guy gets $3 million, $5 million, whatever the going rate is these days, and he'll do whatever you want. But even better, this is what they do. They set up a situation where you do something that's criminal, and they record it. And now they got you on the hook for nothing. That's what goes on these days. It's interesting when people go against that, then something really bad happens to them. Look at Bill Cosby. Again, I don't have the facts. You can say it is suspicious, certainly. Bill Cosby is being tried by the media right now and being tried by people who don't have almost any facts at all. But one thing I do know is Bill Cosby is worth between $350 million and $400 million. And the way the system works is the 1% want all the money, all being, you know, 99%. We operate with the 1% of the money. They want the 99%. When someone's got $350 or $400 million, they will not sleep until they have that person's money under their control. Total control. They will do whatever they have to do to get that money. I've seen it. I've been around it. Uncomfortably close to it, I put it that way. I have seen how ruthless and nonstop they are around someone who has a lot of money. So all I know is for sure is Cosby has a lot of money. And he's at an age where he's not going to be here too much longer. And they want it. Cosby's going to make his final financial moves. Maybe he's already made them. And so that's why they have to cook this all up so that they will devalue the money that they can't get. That's the only part of the story that makes any sense to me. Why would people, you know, be assaulted and then go back to somebody? Many of them, supposedly. Why would people be assaulted and have evidence on themselves, let's put it that way, fluid evidence, and then not have someone test that evidence? Why wouldn't people speak up? It's just not enough to say someone is so powerful. That's just not enough. I don't think that's all of it. All it takes right now, all it would take for what's happening with Cosby to happen, from a conspiracy point of view, all it would take is for, let's say, 15, 20 people to get together in a room. Here's the script. You hand them the script. Your part in the script is here. You're Bob. And you're Susan. And then these people just follow the script. He did this to me. This happened on this date and he did this to me. Yeah, it would take a good script writer. It's an elaborate story. It may be a true story. We may be watching the Cosby documentary right now. But we could also be watching the Cosby movie. And I don't know, one way or the other. I will never know, and honestly, I don't really care, because I only dislike the media in this, and the power players. let's say hypothetically that Cosby did one or more times what is being talked about. He didn't do it in a vacuum. The system supported him. The system of people who make a lot of money from comedians, a lot of money from movie stars. The studio types. Which is to say the 1%. The 1% are behind studios. They're behind everything. They choose what happens and what doesn't. They chose to let Cosby happen because he was useful. And then now they choose to let him not happen, to go away in the worst kind of way. Because, you know, regardless of what happens, let's say, you know, nothing can be done, it's too late, statute of limitations, there's no evidence, yada yada. Nothing's done, right? Well, Cosby's life is ruined. They've taken the Cosby name on a piece of paper and they've erased it. Just rubbed it right off the page. Made a hole in the paper, they rubbed it so hard. What did they accomplish by that? Basically, they said, if I can't have it, you can't have it. That much I know for sure. The rest is speculation. All right, I have a great number of stories this week to get through, so I'm not going to do it. I'll save them. And I have so many, I'm going to probably get into a backlog situation, and who knows, maybe everyone is bored of them. I wouldn't blame you. The stories serve a purpose. The proving the numbers stories serve a purpose, but we'll switch, and we'll do our of the weeks. Bad driver of the week. There was a story on CNN. Minivans fail spectacularly in crash tests. And this is well-known minivans. At least three of them. Super well-known minivans. Just think about the most well-known minivans. Quote, minivans are a popular choice among safety-conscious parents. But three of them fail spectacularly in the small overlap front crash test. They showed pictures where the front of these vans was so crunched there was no room for a person's feet in the car. They had to pry the dummies out of the car after the test. Now the goal in these tests, to get the highest rating, is you get out of the car yourself. There's no damage. You know, I wonder if anyone is surprised that minivans are dangerous. To me, a minivan is dangerous or undesirable on every single level. They ride like crap. They get terrible gas mileage. They fill the road. They are hard to see the corners of. In other words, you have big blind spots. Probably the number of people killed every year by a minivan changing lanes is probably not a small number. They're hard to work on. The engine is tucked underneath the front of the car, like often inside the car. So you have to work at it in the worst possible way. Well, the problem is when you can't access an engine is you don't check it. You don't check the oil yourself. You don't maintain it. It's my truck. And typically with trucks, you know, you open the hood and you can literally climb inside. There's so much room in there. Well, the point is you can easily work on everything. When I flip my truck open, I like looking at the engine. It's simple. I understand everything there. I can see if oil is dripping or there's some dirt or some leaves are inside and I get the leaves out of there. So that every time I look at that engine, it looks okay. And if it doesn't, it would stand out. Well, there's no standing out with a minivan. You literally avoid taking the cover off it. And you don't even necessarily want someone else to do it because it's a bloody hassle and it probably costs money. The whole experience of riding in a minivan, like for the passengers, it's like you're cattle in a cattle car. It's like you're riding on a bus. You're disconnected. I don't think people should have disconnected experiences. As soon as you have a lot of disconnected experiences, you become disconnected. It's a bad thing. When I ride in my truck or I have passengers in my truck, we know we're riding in a truck. We're connected. We can see the road. For one thing, a truck is higher up than a van. You can see the road really well. I love being higher up in a vehicle. I love that view. It's informative. And you can see what's happening further down the road than a van. I just don't want to give that up ever. I love driving a truck. I never thought I would, but I truly do. It's just fascinating how useless minivans are. My re-listen of the week is also my re-watch of the week. I re-watched the documentary, PBS public television documentary, My Life as a Turkey. This is the guy who is known for, you know, hanging out with the animals type thing, and a natural type guy. And one day, somebody anonymously put a dog dish full of wild turkey eggs on his porch. And he started to try and hatch these eggs. And then he raised these hatchlings until these turkeys became adults and eventually went out on their own in the world. But when you hear this guy talk, when you see the filming, you realize this is a world-class documentary. I've watched it numerous times, at least 3 or 4 times already. I listened to the audio in my truck day before. And you just start to think about how the hype versus the reality. You know, when we're kids, we want to see whatever the popular movie is. Let's call it Star Wars. And then when we get into our middle years, then we graduate to, well, typically stupid, even more, you know, inappropriate choices, you know, violent movies and just all kinds of disgusting, gross stuff. And then maybe around age 40, we start to go, you know, and maybe we start to change what we like to watch. For me personally, around the age of 40, I started to lose an interest in boxing. When I was younger, you know, my dad liked boxing, and so we'd watch. And around age 30 or 40, I started to lose interest in it. I didn't want to watch it. And even though I love watching ESPN, I never watched boxing. And MMA, the mixed martial arts, it's really the same story, if not worse. Because they can hurt each other in with their feet as well as their hands, right? So maybe when you get to around 50, you start to realize that movies in general start to look pretty ridiculous. The formula, they all follow formulas, all being 99.9%. 99% of them stink. They have agendas. They are just poorly done in one way or another. Occasionally there's a good actor. But you know, you can rewatch good movies. You don't have to go to the theater looking for new good movies. We know which ones they are. If you watch Gandhi 1 time or 10 times, you'll enjoy it each time. You'll get something out of it. It's an amazing movie. So at some point, for me anyway, around age 50, I just went, documentaries are the thing. I'm not interested in non-documentaries anymore. I almost can't watch them. I watched one the other day, a movie famous in its time, maybe 15 years ago now. It was compelling in its time. And I rewatched it with the young audience, and they enjoyed it. They got sucked into it. But you know, when you're in your 50s, you wake up and you don't want to waste your life on worthless, pointless, fictional, made-up, agenda-packed things. You just don't want to do that. My life as a turkey is just some guy caring for some chicks, for some wild turkeys. But it is so rich, so human, so natural, so perfect in the music, the filming, the storyline, the twists and turns. I can't look away. That's my must-see TV. It's freely available. I'll have the link. You can just go to pbs.org and you can just watch this for nothing. You don't even need to go to the library. The greatest things are free because they can't sell them because we won't pay for them. The worst things are very expensive because people are fighting all over each other to pay for them. Fascinating. Cool and uncool things of the week. Cool thing of the week. Australian dad creates record-breaking Christmas lights display. Over 1 million lights. 1.194380 million lights. Making up a 3D image of 3 Christmas gifts spanning 3,865 meters squared. Since when do they report an area in meters squared? What does that mean to you? Let's round the number, 4,000 meters squared. How much is that? How much is a square meter? Well, it's pretty close to a square yard. So, roughly 4,000 square yards. It's an area about 200 feet by 200 feet. That's like the width of a football field by the width of a football field. Filled with lights. Last year he got 75,000 visitors. Over the years of his Christmas lights, he's raised $200,000 for his charity. Pretty cool. You know, I'm not much of a fan of fireworks. I think it's a complete and utter waste of money. And Christmas tree lights is always sort of in danger of being in the same category. One of the good trends with Christmas lights is the LEDs. they're less wasteful of electricity, and that's a good thing. Another thing I just really like is, you know, you walk around your neighborhood. I was commenting to someone yesterday, you know, we were walking around and people had just put up their lights, some of them. And we were walking early enough that you needed light. You needed street lights. And just sort of realizing that at this time of year, it's dark more of the day. It's darker in the morning. It's dark in the evening. For some people, you know, they work all day, so they go to work in the dark, they come home in the dark. So you need light. Light is a great invention. And the Christmas tree light is just sort of the ultimate in lighting, right? It's the ultimate celebration of lighting. And this is a perfect time of year to do it, to do that celebrating and to have that lighting. But I like when people use more uniform colors, like a very common thing is they'll wrap a tree with like white lights. I like that look. I like the icicle lighting where they're all white lights. I guess my least favorite kind of lighting is when it's just like a rainbow, a random rainbow of light colors. I don't know why. If you're going to do that to me, you should have a small number of lights. 10 of those lights around your window frame, each of your window frames, and you get the idea. You got your Christmas lights up. Good for you. But if you had, you know, and I've seen houses where they have 1,000 of those lights, big outdoor lights, you know, the outdoor bulbs, and it's just random lights. It's like sometimes you get art projects and little art jewelry type things you can buy, and they put an LED light inside there, and they'll often have a sort of a randomizer, a little disc with different colors on the wheel, and it'll spin around in front of the LED, and it will just give you these random colors, and it'll just go through them over and over again. I don't care for that. If you can bring some order to your lights, the more order in whatever form, the better. And that's just me. For example, I choose not to put up Christmas lights. I think it's just a lot of work and expense for, let's say, a month of the year. It's hard to justify it. And, you know, the irony is you don't see your own lights. You're inside your house, right? You're either at work or you're inside your house. You're not hanging around outside in the dark. Okay, so your lights are for others. Well, if your lights are for others, then it's a matter of, aren't there plenty of lights already to look at? How many do you need? And, you know, personal preference. Anyway, pretty cool of this guy. He's raised money. He likes doing it. You know, he's found his thing. He's following his bliss. Good for him. All right, there was a story. The FedEx driver who sued and won. Reggie Gray thought working for FedEx was his ticket to a better life. This isn't the seriously uncool thing of the week. It turned out to be anything but. His years as a driver for FedEx Ground ended with him filing for bankruptcy and taking the company to court. He's one of thousands of FedEx drivers who have sued the company for classifying them as contractors rather than employees. Gray had to purchase his own delivery route for $5,000. He bought his own van, for $17,000. FedEx later made him buy another vehicle for $11,000 and hire a second driver when his route got so busy that one van wasn't enough. Vehicles needed constant maintenance. It all came out of his pocket. He paid for FedEx uniforms and decals for his van, company mapping software, leased a FedEx scanner for package barcodes, had to pay the Department of Transport inspections, random drug tests for the company. FedEx managers in the terminal where he worked hounded him about the condition of the tires on his van and the conduct of the driver he hired. His supervisors constantly threatened to revoke his contract and docked his pay with inflated claims for lost packages. In one case, the company charged him $1,600 for a $400 box of vitamins that he failed to deliver. The debts piled up, and Gray was forced to file bankruptcy in 2008. The financial turmoil took a toll on his marriage, which ended in divorce. He almost lost his house. Before taxes and expenses, Gray said he brought in between $50,000 and $70,000 a year. After paying all of his dues, insurance, and the other driver, his net income ranged from $25,000 to $35,000 a year. At that rate, he was earning roughly minimum wage while putting in 12 to 16 hour days. In my notes, I say, never underestimate how scummy a company can be. This is FedEx doing this. This is what happens when companies find a loophole. This is what companies do. They have no heart. They don't care. This world is run by companies now. It's run by ugly people in charge of ugly companies. Quote of the week. This is from Senator John C. Danforth, telling Marion Barry at a 1989 hearing on the D.C. budget. He says, "Some governments are corrupt, but are known for their competency in running the city. Others are incompetent, but considered clean. Washington's government is scandalously corrupt and hopelessly incompetent." Well, not exactly news, but you have to say it. You have to fully realize it. Washington's government is scandalously corrupt and hopelessly incompetent. Now here's the thing. Why would you vote for him? Why would you waste your time and energy on a vote? Why would you choose a party? Why would you register and take time off work to go and vote? Why would you have anything to do with it? If you really are smart about this, you have an anti-vote. You give people a hard time who do vote. It's a bottom-up movement where you get everyone. The goal is to have everyone not vote. They can't continue to operate if they have no votes. This system of scumbags in the highest places, we keep it going. We keep it going with our own naivety, with our own false optimism, baseless optimism. We gotta sink these suckers, and we do it from the ground up. We do it by not partaking of things that are ridiculous. Politics is ridiculous. All right, maybe one more quote, just a little bit of humor, and it kind of matches up with my own mood at the moment. Patience was not my strong point. This is Lauren Bacall, whose real name was Betty Joan Persky. Anyway, what's interesting with Lauren, which is to say Betty Persky, let's look at her name. Lauren had some spice. Lauren had a lot of opinions, and I really enjoyed when she passed away recently. When I was researching this person and looking for good quotes from her, there was plenty to draw from. You need some spice. You need to have some opinions. When your life is over, there should be some thoughts rolling around in other people's brains that you put there. So Betty, 549, the 9 adding intensity to the 5. And by the way, Betty Joan Persky, a 5 in the birthday. And then from the 854 to the close of life, and she was 90, so she was under that last influence for quite a long time. She was a 5 under a 7. And the 7 is that depth of thought. So the 5 is the truth, no matter what. The 7 is that depth. Well, old Lauren Bacall, she had some depth to her. Patience was not my strong point. That's good. I think that's actually good. Now, there are times when we have to be patient. We have to be able to turn it on or turn it off. If you're assembling an IKEA desk, you have to be patient. If you're dealing with some routine task like doing the laundry, you have to be patient. There's no frantic five-ish way of doing the laundry. It's a four-ish task. But when it comes to our opinions and our view of the world, what we put up with and what we think of, what we see around us, we have to be five-ish, among other qualities. The 5 can be naive and get sucked into things. We don't want to be just five-ish. But the 5 is a truth seeker, and we have to seek the truth. And so her saying patience is not my strong point, what she's really saying is, whenever I'd find someone who was lying, I didn't tolerate that very well. That's what she's really saying. Well, this has been Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 42 for December 1st, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.